Hello, and welcome to What Is Wrong With Hiring, the podcast where we talk about why hiring people and getting hired are both absolute nightmares. I'm Laura Klein, a once and future hiring manager.
And I'm Amy Santee, a never in the past and future hiring manager, but I am a career coach.
Please be advised that this podcast may contain drinking, swearing, and screaming into the abyss. So pretty much like most podcasts.
Today we have our first listener request grab bag episode. So thank you to everyone who submitted a question for the show. I actually printed all the questions out onto small pieces of paper and folded them up to draw at random out of a purple Crown Royal bag that I found in the junk drawer. So I'll be asking the questions and Laura can do the actual work of answering them.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, the first question that I have actually is, so what happened to that Crown Royal, Amy? Were you going to share that or no?
I think that's a memory from my past with my parents who stored like pennies in them or something. Like
those old bags. Does every house come with a junk drawer that comes with a lot of like takeout food menus and also a random dusty Crown Royal bag? Am I showing my age?
No, I think that's everyone's house has something like that.
So all kidding aside, we do have some great questions to kick us off. And a few we have rephrased for brevity or humor or to anonymize them because a few of the people asked to be anonymous. And that is totally fine. We are not here to share all of your secrets with the world. We do plan to do listener requests every now and then, so please continue to send us your burning questions. We did not get to all of them, so if you submitted one and we didn't get to it, probably come in later. Amy, what's our first question?
Yes, question number one. Are you ready?
as I'll ever be.
Laura, what are your thoughts on hiring managers asking people to complete unpaid take-home assignments as part of the interview process? Are these effective? Are they really necessary?
Okay, so I know I've addressed this in like other podcasts, but I just want to be very clear. I fucking hate these, all right? Yeah. This is specifically to unpaid, but I'm going to actually throw in paid. I don't think they pay enough. And B, the reason that I hate them is that I don't think they're effective specifically for UX design and most research, or honestly, even like a programming take home thing feels weird, because in none of those jobs is that the way that you're supposed to do the job. Let me explain. Mm-hmm. I think that we should interview people in a way that helps us assess whether or not they can do the job we are hiring them for. Makes perfect sense. So asking them to do something else where it's, oh, go ideate and design this thing in 4 hours that doesn't have a real clear success criteria and you haven't had a chance to do any research, you don't know anything about the users. I literally don't want anybody to ever design anything like that. That is a bad way of designing things. Or more to the point, it is a good way of designing things that are bad for users. So if somebody's great at that, it really tells me nothing about whether or not they'll be good at the job. Yeah. I actually feel slightly differently about whiteboard tests, which isn't asked about here, but like some jobs do require being able to get up in front of a whiteboard and facilitate a session. And if that is a job that I expect you to be able to do, I might ask you to do it in the hiring experience. But it is just, it's a bad way of assessing the thing that you care about, right? That's my opinion. And that has nothing to do with whether you're paying them or not. Also, just why are we asking people to do 8 hours of homework? I don't know.
It's like everyone else does it, so it must be the right thing to do, and therefore we should do it too. And yeah, it can take a lot of work. You can give someone constraints like, oh, only spend 2 hours on this. But so many people feel like they need to make this thing perfect and are going to spend way more time on it than they actually need to or should. It's even worse if you don't give any time constraints or specific instructions about what to include or what not to include. I know people who have spent entire weekends working on this kind of shit.
And then you're very much biasing against people who maybe don't have a weekend to spend on a bunch of extra work. And especially nowadays, people are going through a lot of different interviews. So how many of these fucking things do I need to do? There is nothing that I can assess from one of those that I cannot assess from a really deep dive portfolio review where we go through something you've already designed, whatever it is, and I ask you questions about why you made the decisions that you did. I am going to get a much better view, I think, of how you work and how you talk about your work and how you make decisions and how you make compromises and trade-offs by doing something like that.
Exactly. I think you pointed out exactly what we need to be thinking about, which is, what is the goal? What are you trying to assess? And what is the best way of doing that? And it makes me think of the fact that most people who hire, they don't know how to assess people according to theories about performance and all of that stuff. Maybe they have experimented with different things over time. So you can do it effectively. But I think asking yourself, what really is the point of this? Is there a way I can do it that is more efficient and more fair to that person? Because if you already have a job and you're interviewing, it's going to take a lot of time away from the rest of your life, your home life, your work life. If you are unemployed, looking for a job can be a full-time job and then some. So imagine being asked to do all of this stuff outside of the interview process.
Yeah, I'm going to say, if you have the privilege of doing this and you are asked, please push back and say you won't interview for it. I understand that many of you do not have that. So one of the things that you are going to hear in some of these listener answers is, yes, this sucks and it shouldn't be the case, but it is. And so you have to do it. You can use all of those reasons to tell people, but you are not in a position of power generally when you're interviewing. So sorry, You may still have to do them.
That's the thing. I think we can try to influence how these things happen as candidates or job seekers by pushing back or just saying no, but also providing feedback. If you say no and you pull out of the interview process, say, it's because this is too much. Mm-hmm. And having that feedback maybe can help the recruiter, hiring manager make better decisions and make it more fair. I think the bias part of it is definitely really relevant, especially if we want to create more inclusive hiring practices.
Yep. So here's a related one. We got question number two, and I think it is very, very similar. Sometimes it feels like candidates are asked to complete the 12 labors of Hercules when interviewing, beyond just the take-home exams. How many rounds of interviews and assignments is actually reasonable?
I've seen a trend of people going through 8, 10, 12 hours of interviews and take-home assignments, not to mention all of the communication and the other stuff that's required as part of the process. And it varies from company to company. It also depends on, I think, like the size of the company and the infrastructure that they have in place, which those companies, the larger ones, the FANGs and some others, they do tend to have more of a bloated interview process. It could also be that maybe you're interviewing at a smaller company, the team you're looking at isn't that big, and there are folks higher up who feel like they need to be involved in the process of assessing candidates. I think it goes back to what we were saying before about what is actually necessary. Can you save yourself time and money, because hiring is expensive, by reducing the amount of conversations and tasks that need to be involved? If you get 500 resumes, there really is no reason to look at all of those. So it's about reducing it from all of these different angles, but especially the interactions that you have with candidates.
Yeah. But again, as a candidate, you will go through the number of rounds that you will go through, and there is very little that you can do to control it. The one thing that you can do, which is helpful, I think, is you can ask up front what the process looks like. And you can, most good companies will do this. When I was hiring, I would always walk them through what you can expect next. Like, there will be the portfolio review, there will be three individual interviews, and then we decide. The interesting thing is, I think when we used to do things in office more, and I think some companies definitely are getting back to this, you'd come in for a day, right?
Yep.
You just come in for a day, you do it back to back. It's exhausting. And I hate mm-hmm. as the kind of person who gets very tired by human interaction. It yes. was a bad day for me. By the end, it was the filter was just completely off. So if you were lucky enough to get me in hour 8 of the interview, you were going to hear some stuff. It was like, that was the thing. And they would just line it up and at least you'd be done with it. And then you could get on with your life. Now that things are on Zoom, there's one and then there's another one in 2 days. And people are, the thing that I don't understand is from the company's point of view, it's really expensive to have that many people go through like your scheduling time with all of these like managers and directors and PMs and engineers, like everything. Jesus, that's not free. I just think people don't factor that in.
This might sound radical, but I think candidates should be paid for all of this work. If you think about it, candidates are the only people in the entire interview process who aren't compensated for the labor that goes into this. And this is about the necessity of having a job to live, and we have to do it. And there's a lot involved. We might have jobs already. We have families. We're busy. But we have to invest so much time and energy into these interview processes. Again, it might sound like a weird concept, but why don't we pay people for all of this?
Yeah, I don't necessarily know that everybody should get paid for that first half an hour chat with the recruiter. But at the point that you're actually asked to like, oh, you're going to put together a portfolio, or you're going to walk us through some code samples, or yeah, I don't have a problem with that. It's in a way you could actually even compensate people like you do for user research. An Amex gift card at the end of it. Again, the what is reasonable and what is likely going to happen to you don't really have anything to do with each other. So all we can say is once you get that job, hey, maybe work to change it within your company. Remember what it was
like. I like that.
Remember your roots.
Yeah. And you get the job, you start, and you provide some feedback to the manager, to the recruiter about the experience that you went through and suggestions for how to make that better for everyone. Yeah, I like that. All right.
All right.
Question number 3. There's conflicting advice about whether or not to apply for jobs if you don't meet all of the qualifications or requirements. So some people say to apply, just go ahead and apply because the posting is really a checklist for the ideal candidate. And then other people say that you shouldn't bother if you don't meet the essentials or 100%.
So this is a fun one because this varies based on a lot of different criteria. For example, right now, applying when you don't meet 100% is going to be less effective than it might have been a couple of years ago, right? So it's a bad, it's one of those things where it's, is it a buyer's market or a seller's market? And, you know, right now it's very much on the side of the companies. So you might have, you know, 80% of the experience, but you might be competing against somebody who has 120%. So that is a thing to consider, but it shouldn't necessarily prevent you. The other thing is that a lot of times people say, oh, apply if you have 80%, if you meet a certain, but here's the thing, 80% isn't always 80%. All job requirements and even essentials aren't the same. Take, for example, years of experience. I've hired for a lot of mid-level roles, and I'll get people who I would consider to be quite junior applying for those roles. And I've also had people who I would consider to be absolute newbies apply for those roles. And the people who are like a little more junior, but have some good other qualities might get interviewed, right? The difference between 3 and 5 years of experience is actually very different than 3 and 1 years of experience, right? Mm-hmm. Or 2 years of experience and no experience. It's not the same 2 years. I need somebody who has done a job before in the industry as a designer or researcher or programmer or whatever. And even having something like a master's degree won't necessarily make up for no experience. It might make up for a couple of years of experience if you're farther along in your career. So it's there's that kind of stuff. If it's things like, oh, you should know, sometimes they put in things like, oh, you need to know Figma and Sketch and Framer and Adobe products and blah, blah, blah. No, you fucking don't. You need to know how to use design tools and how to learn new design tools that maybe you haven't used before in order to produce artifacts. And you need to be able to show that you have done that, because basically what that's saying is, can you make stuff in the way that we do? And this is what we use. And yeah, okay, great. But you'll pick it up, right?
I think that's why people need to understand what is required of these roles and look across job postings to look for the trends and commonalities, because job descriptions will vary from company to company. Like you said, someone who has 4 years of experience at one place can be considered a senior, and then seniors 8 years. And those numbers, I think, are like heuristics, right? It doesn't always correspond to the quality of our work. Mm-hmm. And I think whether or not it's 80 or 90 or 70 or 100, the reality is that the threshold has changed due to the market. So people used to say, oh, meet 70, 80% of the requirements, go ahead and apply. Now it is higher. There's just more people looking. I would still say if you meet all of the requirements, all of the essentials, then yes, apply. If there's a section of nice to haves and you meet some of those or you don't meet some of them, those are nice to haves. Also, think about your unique positioning compared with other candidates. Maybe there's one thing that you don't have, but you have a lot of other stuff that can make up for it. If you can present that clearly, then I would say go ahead and apply.
For example, if they're literally looking for somebody who has, for example, you know, if they're mentioning things like pixel perfect and all of these kinds of very specific things that imply great visual design, and you are more of, say, a content designer or an information architect like me, I will never apply to a job that implies that I need to produce anything pixel perfect, because I have never produced anything pixel perfect, nor will I. I can't make up for not having that necessarily with, oh, but I'm really good at research and I'm really good at mental models or interactions or any of that. So those are the kinds of things to look for where it does matter. If you don't have that, you're probably not going to be considered. But I mean, to be fair, you can apply anyway. Just don't get your hopes up. I'm perfectly happy to look at your resume and perfectly happy to say, no, this person doesn't have what I want. Is it worth your time? Consider that. The only person's time you're wasting is your own.
Yes, being selective is important. And something I've learned from following a lot of recruiters on LinkedIn and YouTube is that most people who apply for jobs aren't actually qualified enough. And I've seen many of them cite, oh, about 20% of people who apply to the jobs that I put out there are qualified. So it's important to be qualified. And yes, if you don't get the job or you get rejected, don't read too much into it if you are a fit. So let's assume you're a fit for the role, you're a great candidate, but you don't get a response or you get a rejection letter the next day. It probably has nothing to do with you. Someone else was a bit more qualified. That person was just going to hire someone that they know.
Internal candidate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many reasons. And a lot of people internalize a rejection as something's wrong with me as a candidate. Something's wrong with my resume. So I need to tweak it 8 million times. No, just you applied and you didn't get it. So move on.
Yep. All right. Next question. What the heck is going on right now with recruiters seeking candidates for UX writer positions at huge companies with descriptions that sound fantastic until they quote hourly rates that are abysmally low? This was I wanted to take this question because the writer said, I'm talking $35 an hour for Coca-Cola or $45 an hour for a huge insurance company. And I think the real question here is the market really that flooded that like good talent's accepting $35 an hour? That's real bad.
It's bad. I think I got paid like $35 an hour for tutoring in 2010. Not that tutoring is just a walk in the park, right? It requires some skill. But my point being that, yes, these are absolutely too low. But this was a problem before the layoffs. And so I got into UX in 2011. And I have paid very close attention to hourly rates for freelance and contracting just over time, doing it on my own, staying aware of that stuff and seeing what other people get paid. And hourly contract rates through staffing agencies, they have been pretty stagnant and low, generally speaking, especially in the latter half of the 2010s when, with UX anyway, there were a lot more openings, a lot more people trying to go into the field. Maybe there's some desperation there, whatever. Then they're going to be accepting the low rates that are provided. I think in part because they don't actually know what they should be making. They don't know how to negotiate. So I think there's different factors there. But yes, especially now that the market is flooded with people, full-time positions are harder to come by, then yes, supply and demand, unfortunately, is a factor of the market. Now, it doesn't mean that your work and the value of your labor is worth $35. It's probably worth $350. It's probably worth tens of thousands of dollars in financial impact to this company, but they're going off of supply and demand. Another part of it too is the business model of staffing agencies or contracting firms. So they are given a budget from the client that they have to work with. And of course, they would like to get some kind of cut or percentage of that. And there are staffing agencies that are sketchy and lowball. And then there are staffing agencies and recruiters who try to be fair and try to pay people what, you know, is a fair rate, relatively speaking.
Sometimes they do offer other stuff. So that's, you have to look at that, right? Is this a staffing agency that's going to offer you like health insurance? Having worked in agencies before, they have to take a piece because that's how they make money. And so people are like, oh, they're taking the money for my work. Like, yeah, but they're making it so you don't have to go out and get on somebody's approved vendor list and get business insurance for it and drum up your own business and deal with the fallout if like you flake. They're taking on some risk for you. They deserve something. I don't know that they necessarily deserve as much as some of them take, but you know, deserve is a tricky question there. It's like the question isn't, you know, in the world that we live in, the question isn't, what do you deserve? The question is, what can you get? And another big thing that I will say with UX writing, just as somebody who has been through this before with user research and interaction design and all of the other things that we do, UX writing is, I'm going to say something that's going to piss off every single UX writer out there. It's the new kid on the block. Mm-hmm. I know it's been around for a while, but it hasn't been around for as long as what we used to call interaction design. It hasn't been around for as long as we've been trying to get user research thrown into things. And when you're the new kid, you're the first one to get cut or misunderstood. And it's a tricky job because in some places, it's very much what I might used to call like an information architect, which are very expensive, very highly paid roles that are basically doing like strategy and taxonomy and categorization and all sorts of tricky mental model stuff and things that are just really very different. And in some places, they are writing content, you know, for websites, or they are doing marketing copy, or they are writing, you know, making sure that the labels on forms are correct. And I'm not saying that those aren't important. I am saying that there are more people who can do those well. Mm-hmm. And those are not as valued of a position. And everything in between, by the way, I am massively oversimplifying. There are also people who like make sure that the whole tone and strategy and content and everything of an entire product or suite of products is consistent and part of the design system. And so there are those folks. So there's a whole, I know there's a range. The problem is when you're hearing $35 an hour, you may be hearing $35 an hour from a company that really wants you writing headers. And right, that might be what they're going to pay for that.
Try to find data on compensation, on hourly rates, ask around, use your network to find out what the landscape is looking like. And it is absolutely possible to negotiate hourly contract rates. I've heard of people getting $10 more, $50 more if you have a rationale, if you have data, if that organization really wants you, then you have leverage. So definitely negotiate. And also, this is a great reason for unionizing. And it could be a trade union, like a UX union. It could be at your company. It could be freelancers. It could be contractors, right? Like we're seeing a lot of activity in that regard. But when you have collective organizing to demand things that you deserve, right? Because that is an important question. What do you deserve versus what's being offered? And you can use leverage to not provide labor, then that is an option. And not just in tech, but we're seeing it with the writer's strike and the auto workers' strikes. So there, it's great to see the activity happening with that. And it's not just for factory workers and UPS drivers. It is for any kind of worker.
Yeah, I think the writers and actors unions are actually a great model. It's a very good example of an industry that has at least made an effort to take care of its people for a very long time.
Yes, there's a lot of opportunity for people working in tech to look into this and ride that wave. I expect to see a lot more of this in the coming years. So we have one more question. Sometimes hourly contract roles are eventually converted to full-time. How do conversion salaries typically compare to the hourly rate? And the person who sent us this question said that they saw an hourly rate much lower than the promised salary conversion. Do companies actually pay more for the same role once they decide to hire you?
Okay, so this is one of those things that we actually covered a little bit in the podcast about business models that talked about this in more depth. Once again, the thing that is best for you is your contract rate should be considerably higher than your hourly rate, which is your salary divided by whatever it is, 2,000, something like that, to figure out what is your hourly. If you make $100,000 a year and you divide that by, I think it's 2,000, that's your hourly rate. But that actually should be lower than your contracting hourly rate because you are not paying things in the US like payroll taxes, health insurance benefits, contributing to your 401k. You are not getting benefits like paid vacation. You are not getting benefits like all the other bullshit, free snacks, stocks, or stocks, bonuses, all that stuff. You have no idea the sheer amount of money that I cost a company in those peanut butter filled pretzels, which is why I don't go into offices anymore because those are not healthy. And if I am around one of those Kirkland sized boxes of them, my body will become like 80% peanut butter filled pretzels. I'm just saying that is a benefit, I guess. I don't know. The gym membership better be free if I'm doing that. But that's what it should be. And what we see is companies doing this other bullshit where they're like, yeah, we're going to try out for 3 months and give you this much lower rate. And if we like you, we'll give you this wonderful golden egg at the end of it. And it's, okay, but will they? Because what's really their incentive to convert somebody at a much lower rate to a much higher rate? It feels like the incentive there is bad. So I would be careful with that and maybe check and see if they've ever actually converted anybody.
I remember at my last in-house job, I went in as a contractor for about a year and I busted my ass as though I was a full-timer. I just had a high work ethic. I wanted to produce quality stuff. I also wanted to get converted to full-time and I almost didn't because they had to scrounge around and somehow come up with this budget to bring me on, which was always the intention. But it may not have happened unless my coworkers had advocated to get me hired on as a full-timer. So nothing is certain, even though at the time of hiring you as a contractor, they might say, yes, we think that we're going to be able to convert you in 6 months or a year or 2 years.
Yeah, you want to be real careful because a lot of times they'll do that. Oh, we're going to bring you on as a contractor because we don't have the budget yet, but we're going to get the budget. And I'm like, I've been in those resource planning processes. They do not have any idea if they will get the budget. Mm-hmm. So much shit can happen that will mean they do not have the budget. So that's why you need to make sure that your contracting rate is a thing that you would be happy just taking as your rate and not counting on that conversion. Now, again, do companies pull this shit? Yes. Should they? You can't trust businesses. They are not doing what is right for you. They are doing what is right for them by default. So keep that in mind when you're asking yourself, what's going to happen in the future? I don't know. If I knew that, I would play the lottery.
And businesses are different from people. Your hiring manager might really want to bring you on. They're going to try really hard, but they might be dealing with stuff that pretty much just prevents them from doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me tell you how much power I have over things like new job recs as a hiring manager. And the answer is, yeah, it's not really up to me.
Yes. So.
And again, smaller companies, you have a little bit more, but again, smaller companies oftentimes are startups, and so they may have even less realistic projections of what's going to happen next. Again, make sure that you're getting paid what you should get paid, whether you're going to get converted or not, and just assume that whatever you're hired as, that's what you're going to be. And if what you really need is a full-time job, look for full-time jobs. Feel free to do it while you're contracting. They haven't promised you anything. You're not, they haven't put a ring on it yet.
No, get a job contracting, keep looking for full-time work or contracts that pay better, and you don't need to give them notice. Just quit. It's a business relationship, right? Like, they can fire you at any point for any reason. The last thing I'll say on this is, don't take an amount of money that makes you feel disrespected. You don't want to go into the job feeling underpaid. It's not going to make your work enjoyable. It's going to make you potentially feel resentful about being there.
I'm resentful about being at work full stop, like even That's if they're true. Paying me well. So I don't know. Your mileage may vary on that. But no, I 100% agree. It's if they're, remember, they have brought you on as a contractor because they can get rid of you quickly.
Yeah.
That's the point. So feel free to do whatever you got to do. You should never feel guilty. Hell, even if you're working there full time, you should never feel guilty about taking a better thing someplace else, which is a different podcast that we should talk about doing. But that is all the time that we have for today. Again, if there is a question or topic that we didn't discuss today, and we know that there were a few that folks sent in, we will get to them. But if you have a new one, please reach out to us on LinkedIn. And by us, I mean Amy, who actually responds to things on LinkedIn. We really do appreciate them because, you know, occasionally we run out of stuff to talk about and we want to know what you want to know about. with that, I am Laura.
And I'm Amy.
And we want to thank you all for listening and wish you all the best of luck with your search. No matter what you're looking for, we are rooting for you.